So you were at what at the station where the RAF would have called you the armaments officer?
Yes.
Can you?
I was the air gunnery officer.
Air gunnery officer.
The naval expression for it.
Yes.
So as well as the armaments, I was also responsible for. Let me get the words. Things like guards and mounting guards. I can't think of the word for it.
Okay. Well, don't worry.
Formal. And funeral firing parties, I'm afraid. I can answer that. Ceremonial, that's the word I was thinking of. I was responsible for ceremonial three. But also, of course, the training, the initial training of the squadrons that came in, perhaps in air combat, not that I took part in it myself, because the squadron commanders did that. I remember that extremely well. It was merely a matter of keeping in contact with them. We had one or two frontline squadrons. And we had American aircraft, so I had to be briefed around myself and learn about American armaments and American aircraft. So these are details, but they're very important. Our standard small machine gun was 303, if you remember. American one was 30. And you don't want to get the ammunition mixed up, or the guns for that matter. So American aircraft were difficult from that point of view. And that was it. We had the American aircraft, Hellcats they were called, and they carried bombs and guns. And very good airplanes, they were very easy to maintain, says the air engineer told me. Major engines, air cooled.
And they were modern advanced aircraft?
They were, it's what the Americans were using on their carriers by this time. Yes. And that's what I had to do. I was really impressed by the squadron commanders, who were much more experienced than I was, and they did their own. I would lay on targets for them if they're going to do attacks, like just occasionally carried bombs as well. And I had a range for that, a big pond in the middle of Cheshire. I mean, it was more than a lake, actually. And I much enjoyed the experience, but I wanted to get off to sea. I went from there for a brief spell at Leon Servants, which was headquarters of the Fleet Air at the time. And to my great thrill, from there I went to a carrier, which was building. By this time, 1945.
This is now 1945?
Yes.
So you had spent 18 months in Cheshire.
Cheshire, yes. Another best part of a year at Leon Silver.
Oh, I see, right.
And then I went to the this carrier building in Newcastle, HMS Triumph, light fleet carrier. And I joined it in January, it must be January 1945, by then, if I got it right.
January 45. What is a light fleet carrier?
Well, there were a range of carriers which were built with the ability of the fleet carriers, but they were very much lighter armed. They didn't have armoured decks, for example, and therefore they were very much lighter in weight and infinitely more economical to run, and yet they had the same aircraft power. If I remember rightly, we could operate two squadrons of fighters and two squadrons of TBR, which is four squadrons. And I don't think the fleet carriers could do much more than that. In fact, by the time we finished building, when I went through the motions of arming the ship, getting all the armaments on board, and then we did the trial runs. We embarked two squadrons, one of Fireflies, which was a fighter and you could attack submarines with it, whatever you might call it, and four pure fighters, which were old C-517s, which is the RAF 45, Spitfire 45, same aircraft.
Can you describe the Firefly a bit more?
Firefly is not an interim aircraft. It was an improvement and much greater knowledge on the Fulmar. The Fulmar was a standard fighter in the Fleet Howard through most of the fighting in the Mediterranean against the Italians. It was Merlin engines. I think it only had machine guns firing forward, same as this Spitfire. I don't remember any of them with cannons, but they might have done. But the Firefly had four cannons, two in each wing. Because its use was seen possibly as a ground attack, that's a good word, or ship attack, and rockets. And it certainly had rockets. And it certainly had forward firing 20 millimetre, which is a pretty heavy piece of equipment. So it was potentially a very powerful aircraft. I don't think they ever took part in operations. That's the Firefly. The Fulmar certainly did throughout the Mediterranean campaigns of the carriers. But I don't think, by the time the Pacific War came, we had our Seafowls then and these American Hellcats. But the aircraft was a fleet. So the light fleets, the two were built in this yard called Hawthorne Leslie on the Tyne, and there was another yard on the other side of the Tyne. Hawthorne Leslie on the south side, on the north side, actually, there were two light fleet buildings there, which eventually Centaur and the Mars and strange names like that. We were, mine was the Triumph, and our sister ship was the Ocean. And the two together operated in the Mediterranean very happily from about 1946. And I was certainly there for 2 years. I was the air gunnery officer on the Triumph. I was also this chap, flight deck divisional officer, if that means anything to you. And it was a marvellous commission based on Malta.
So, this is a period that lasted some 2 years from.
Yes, yeah.
And after your ship was worked up and commissioned, you then went to the Med. Can I ask you this? What was the immediate post-war Navy like? As a service, you were a regular commissioned officer?
I was by now a regular commissioned officer.
When did you convert to regular?
Almost overnight, because all Fleet Arrow officers, they targeted Fleet Arrow officers, because nearly the whole of the Fleet Arrow was made up of R&R officers. So when you targeted them, you gave them the opportunity to transfer to general service, with the possibilities, obviously, of promotion, but also to experience general service experience. And of course, I met one or two other people who did the same thing. I was accepted for general service and went to a frigate as first lieutenant. In fact, they did two first lieutenant jobs before I got to command, which was integrating a Fleet Aero officer who was trained almost entirely for flying, with general service. I mean, until I got on board a frigate, I mean, ship navigation was all I thought it was much easier than air navigation, not a bit. And that sort of thing you had to do. And of course, you had to learn the armaments of the fleet or the ships you were going to in advance, because you were going to be examined on them.
Yes.
And I got through those exams.
And so you converted when? Immediately after the war?
No, not until I would say not until 1947.
Right.
Which is the end of my time in.
Which is coming towards the end of your time on
the Triumph.
On the Triumph.
Yes. Yeah. I don't know whether precise moment, and there was quite a lot of it going on, because in Admiralty Fleet Orders it came out of this, you see, firing officer being transferred to general. It's come out every 6 months or so.
Yes.
So I can't remember precisely when that. But the advantage of the Triumph to me was that we were a flagship. So we had an admiral on board, and we were rather friends. You can be friends. He was a very distinguished admiral called Troubridge. He was also a very, very keen cricketer, which helped me immensely, because I had very good cricketer students. No modesty allowed at all. In fact, he summoned me once and said, "What are you going to do when we get back to England?" So I said, "Well, I'm going to a frigate." And he says, "Well, I'm going to put an orange view, because I think Navy cricket needs you in their side. Otherwise, it's all made up of National Service men who are going to disappear in a few weeks' time. And Royal Marines." So after one spell in the frigate, I was then attached to the Royal Marines to do some of that training. And the Commandant Royal Marines sent for me and said, "I've got it as a priority that you've got to be let off to play Navy cricket." Pretty good, wasn't it? Pretty generous.
How many seasons did you play? Would this be combined services cricket?
It's combined services. I was in the combined services side. So in fact, I captained it once.
And you would have known Trevor Bailey, who would have been...
Oh, rather, yes. Yes, yeah. But not all that personally. I doubt whether he'd remember me. Combined services cricket that I played, not many. I got on the side, the Navy side, in 49. And played combined services 50, 51 and 52. And the captains of the combined services was an RAF officer called Alan Shurev, who also Captain Kent. And I played some very high-grade cricket, which I much enjoyed. But when we were in Singapore, when I got appointed back some years later, about 62, the Australian touring side came through Singapore. So I was told, captain of the combined services side, to play the Australian touring side. Now, this was a fair old challenge. And I said, "Do I have any chance to entertain them?" And they said, "Yes, you'll have to do it." The Navy did the entertaining for that particular tour. So I did that, because I was commander of the barracks, and I can arrange that was all under my, all arranged under my command anyway. See? So we had all these Australians into the naval base. And our captain was a chap called Wally Grout. You may or may not know, he's a wicketkeeper.
No, I remember Wally Grout.
And he had all his teeth were broken from being a wicketkeeper. And the two matches we played, we became quite friendly. And he said, "One of the nicest things to me that any Australian cricketer," I said, "but any cricketer for that matter," he said, "if you come out to Australia, John," and we were very quick on Christian names, "and you'll never have to buy yourself a drink." And I haven't dared to get across it. And I'm sure he meant it. So that's where Navy cricket came in, you see. And Trowbridge, as I said, was the admiral in Triumph. He always came to our cricket matches. And he was also a member of the IZ. And he had the magnificent blazer. Have you seen the IZ?
No.
It's particularly brilliant. It's not only got the yellow and red of the empty, it's got a black band as well. And wherever we went, he'd sit down in a prominent place. And I noticed when we were playing against, so it was the Asian sides in Singapore, that there were more spectators round him than there were watching the cricket. So he was quite a man. And his father was a famous Commodore under Nelson, that's right, to get the name, same family. So that was, so now we've got to the end of Triumph. I went and joined and appeared as a frigate first lieutenant, joined the Royal Marines for 2 years, doing that amphibious training, the sea size of it, and then went off as a captain of a frigate.
But at some point, you flew sea fires.
Yes. When we were, I was in Triumph at the time, and we were burst in Recife. And we all pilots were re-scrubbed. This is where I want to get my dates right.
Can you tell me what re-scrubbed means?
Well, you were retrained, virtually.
Retrained?
Virtually retrained. Modern RT, experience of single monoplane type. They were known as single monoplane type, which was Seafires and Fireflies. Navy had Seafires by then. And the conversion course was to Seafires and Fireflies, which I did at the Onsettlement. And then went back to a trial plane into Rosyth, and the commander there said, well, you've got to keep your flying practice. So I went ashore to Tunbridge Bristol and did, and they had Seafires spare there. And watching all of these, I got into trouble in it, 20,000 feet. And I couldn't get it out of a spin, which was a bit frightening. And then I was over land by this time, so I hopped it. Unfortunately, the door in the side of the Spitfire, it's meant for opening, you see, but it won't open in the air. So I released the hood all right, but when I went out, I got badly cut.
Badly cut.
From here, I've got a scar from here right down to there. And that's on the side of the door handle.
That's from the top of your hip bone on the left-hand side of your leg down
to
your...
Right down, half, yes. And I've got a scar the whole way down. And this could have stopped me flying altogether, this sort of damage, but I didn't. I went back to flying in the Triumph, flying those RCS trip. I had a marvellous time in the Mediterranean flying all around the fleet. But the doctor on board realised that I wasn't quite so keen. And took me off flying. That's the end of my flying.
That was the end of your flying career.
Flying career.
Yes.
I've really been exceptional.
So you were taken off flying. I've got several questions for you pertinent to that. Were you happy to be taken off flying, or did you feel within yourself that you were ready to stop flying?
I think I was ready to stop flying. I will admit that I had doubt in my own ability to advance my flying career. I know it sounds a joke, you know, taking the fan away and that sort of thing, but I didn't think I would that I was adapted for a new range of aircraft. I'm never going to find that out, of course. So I reckon, as far as my flying ability was concerned, I'd reached the limit of my ability, and that I knew if I was going to convert to jets, which is the next thing, that I didn't think my heart or desire would have been in it. So I was relieved on two accounts. I was relieved of my flying obligations, and relieved that I'd already been accepted for general service, which was jolly lucky, I think.
Otherwise, you'd have had to have left the Navy, I assume.
Yes. It was always a threat at the time, that when I was taken out of flying, that I realised what was happening. But it was a risk I was prepared to take, but I had been accepted for general service, had appeared in Admiralty Fleet Orders, and I certainly wasn't the only one.
You weren't the only one, the only fleet air arm pilot who had...
taken out of flying and accepted for general service.
Yes.
Well, quite the opposite of general service, and remained on flying entirely. And very few got general service appointments. And one who I knew, who discussed this with one, said, well, if I'm going to general service, I want to go to sea as a general service officer. So the fleet or the Admiralty was geared to this, having to send air crew in general service appointments.
And surely they would be very good as officers on in various capacities on aircraft carriers, ex-fleet air arm pilots, or not?
Yes. I agree with the first part of your question, but I don't think it ever happened.
Did it not?
No. I think it was... if you were going general service, you could expect to go to frigates and destroyers almost straight away. But if you stayed as flying, which you could be general, obviously, then you would go back on Kerosene and flying, purely flying appointments. And that was there was an effort to coordinate the two, giving the impression that the police arrow was a certain set of set. For instance, in the ship, I was in the Triumph, I was second focusal officer. In order that I should learn about anchors and cables, and I was jolly glad to learn about anchors and cables. And I was also, by my seniority, I was senior watchkeeper. So I had responsibility for keeping the officer watch on the bridge. Just a roster, of course, much to the navigator's concern.
What rank were you by this time?
Lieutenant. No more, no less. when did I get to Lieutenant Commander? Not until I was appointed Captain of the ship.
So after you left the Triumph, you then went as First Lieutenant to two separate frigates.
Two separate frigates, yes.
Did... you hadn't had much general service experience, general sea experience, I would have thought, if I can call it that.
No, except what I had in Triumph.
Except what you obtained in Triumph.
I was senior watchkeeper.
Was it quite a jump to find yourself as a first lieutenant of a frigate where you'd had fairly limited general service experience? You had substantial flying experience, but limited general service experience, and suddenly you are the second most important officer on an extremely valuable piece of equipment.
Yes, it was quite a jump. But I had great confidence in myself that I was going to ride this. I may say, I think I had sympathetic captains who were not much senior to me, but they were very experienced. And great support from the other officers in the ship already. And I'm conscious that I managed, that's a word for it. And I passed my, during this time I took these exams, so I felt more able as we went.
But if you had only merely managed, you wouldn't have got a second first lieutenancy, would you?
No, I don't think so.
So perhaps you might have done a bit better.
The first ship had no armoured. It was a training ship, a navigation training ship, obviously out of Portsmouth. All very simple and very nice. We did one or two deep sea operations when fleet exercises in the mid-Atlantic and back here. But I think I managed all right. And the second one, I think I managed very well. A training frigate at Portland, a great training base.
Right.
And a modern frigate.
Well, shall we take a break there and return next time to discuss your second first lieutenancy?
Yes.
And everything else, and the rest of your career and in the Navy and subsequently?
Yes. That's all right.
Fine, yeah. Yes. Thank you very much indeed. Well, Commander, thank you very much indeed for making your time available to finish off this your discussion. Perhaps we'll finish today, I don't know. Finish off your discussion of your career. But I think that before we pick up where we left off, which was the start of your second first lieutenancy, I think we're going to go back a few years to the wartime again. To wartime again, I should say, and your period on HMS Bighton. Before we get into a discussion of one or two of the things that I know you want to raise, could you try and describe for me the atmosphere and what it was like to be on this small escort carrier? Who were you with? How many in the crew? When you're on this small escort carrier, HMS Bighton, in the Atlantic during the height of the Battle of the Atlantic, from November 42 through to the summer of 43, I think.
Yes. first of all, as a squadron, we were delighted to get to sea, because we had been frustrated by a previous ship to which we were assigned was unfortunately sank on its way over from America, where it was being converted. So we went with great joy to see the writer. I can sing a song about it if you like, but I won't. In great enthusiasm, we got the squadron on board. In the meantime, we had been joined by the fighters, whose work and operations I've described, and we completed our flying training, largely concerned with mock attacks on submarines in the Clyde, and then, of course, getting back on board your own carrier, which of course was the only one close operating then, and that was all the operational training. And then, of course, without telling us in advance, we found ourselves heading west, and the captain said we won't be back in England for some time. And that was very exciting for us. We joined the convoy off Northern Ireland.
And this would be when, John?
I'll say March 43, but it could easily have been February or March. I'm sorry.
February or March 43?
Yes.
Yes, okay.
And off we set in northwestern direction. So happened we left this convoy, which was westbound, and we parked in Iceland at Vialfjord, it's known, which is the fleet anchorage, where we were accompanied by two battleships, and we stayed there just for a few days, and off we went westward hard to pick up convoys coming to England. And first of all, on the first two operations we did this, the carrier with its own escorts, and I remember the names of their escorts if it helps at all, Dead Spare and Weir, they're all river class frigates. We stayed away from the convoy a distance of some 20 or 30 miles and operated our aircraft from there by sending them off to the convoy. And in the convoys by then, there was quite good communication between ships and aircraft when they appeared, where we would carry out whatever particular search we were required to do, which started off with one invisibility distance. And then if German submarine transmissions, which became a significant factor, we would be sent off in that direction from where they come. And that certain ships in the convoy had the F-direction finding equipment. We also knew the currency,
frequency.
The frequency on which the Germans were operating. It took them a long time to realise it. The Bursas, we then went right across the Atlantic to Halifax about 3 weeks. And we started the same operation on the way back. And it so happened, a stroke of extraordinary luck, the ex-CO of the squadron was now the operations officer in the carrier. So he was able to talk to us because he'd planned the operations with us. And the air crew generally said, well, this flying, this trip from 30 miles out into the continent out again is a total of 60 miles, and away he goes, whatever it was, 15 gallons of 25 gallons of petrol, and a completely wasted hour. Now, I know we didn't influence the decision, but that's how we suddenly felt. From then on, we parked in a box inside the convoy. And this was a huge success. When we went out on long-range operation, 20 or 30 miles, we knew we had a very good chance, an unfailing chance, of finding the convoy when we turned back, because the ships were particularly easy to pick up on our, what was called ASV, which is the forerunner of radar, at about 30 miles. And back you came. And this was a tremendous confidence restorer.
Just, if you would, just give me a few technical specifications then for the Swordfish. How far from the convoy could you fly? And what was your endurance? How far did you fly, and what was your endurance?
Endurance, I'll say it was a normal tank, because occasionally we had overload tanks, and it was 5 hours. And, of course, you waste a bit of time taking off and getting away from the convoy, but for the usual patrol, it was visible at a distance. And that could go out to about 20 miles. And you were doing that ahead of the convoy, of course. Although occasionally submarines popped up behind us. I know that from other people's experience.